Okay, that looks good. All right, so we're going to start. Bio 241, Human Physiology for Fall 2015. If that's why you're here, that's great. All right, I have the syllabus over here on the right side. All right, so this is Bio 241. This is a hybrid class, and so you have to have good internet connection and computer. Make sure your internet connection is working just fine because you've got to interact with Blackboard and a number of other online resources. So if you don't like hybrid or online classes, this might not be the right class for you, but most people find it really handy. Like for instance, when I record a lecture, it's going to be online so you can listen to it over and over and over again. So that could be handy to fill in notes. All right, I can show you some things on the screen on the right-hand side, but I can't scale anything for some reason, and all the control figures are up off the top that I can't get to. So we're missing the left-hand side of every page, but that's okay. I think we can fill in some information. This class isn't too complicated. There is a lecture component and a lab component. The lecture component has on-campus tests, and they're about an hour and a half long. There's going to be four of them, exam 1, 2, 3, and 4, including the one on our last day of school, which is Thursday. And you'll have a lecture on that Tuesday. That's a really short turnaround time. But that's how all classes are on campus these days. And in lab, you'll have a quiz every week, but you won't have a practicum. So you have quizzes in lab, you have lecture exams in here, and then you have a weekly quiz online to do every week as well. So let's take a look at the schedule for just a little bit. All right, so today's the 25th indeed. We're going to have an introductory lecture. This is probably a pretty important lecture because we're going to talk about homeostasis. And we're going to learn something about homeostasis, and you're going to apply that knowledge every day you come to class and every day you go to lab. You want to understand homeostasis and how what we're doing fits into that concept. First part of the class you see is chemistry, and I hope all of you have taken some kind of college-level chemistry before signing up for this class. It is not a prerequisite in the schedule of classes or in the college catalog, but it should be. There's just some administrative reasons from the nursing program why we cannot include it, but most reputable colleges do make college-level chemistry a prerequisite for a physiology class. So those of you that have a little bit of chemistry background, these first couple of lectures are going to be really easy, and the questions on the test will be really easy, but don't think the whole class is going to be easy like that, right? So if you've got a really strong background in chemistry and no background in biology or anatomy, then don't forget, you're going to have to really gear up your study techniques. So those of you that really apply yourself really hard on these first, chapter two chemistry, then you're kind of good to know how you have to study for the rest of the class, right? All right. Well, there are a number of people that are not registered for the class just yet, and so I want to explain how you find your way into this class. We have a couple extra empty seats in here, but where we are really limited is in the laboratory. I can only have 25 students in laboratory. So if you want to add the class, you got to go to the beginning of lab period, wait outside with all the other students. I'll take roll call immediately when class starts. So right at that time, like there's a class at 1 o'clock today, I'll take roll call exactly at 1 o'clock. So if you are registered, don't come at 1:05 because chances are I will have dropped you already. All right, so those that want to add, get there right at 1 o'clock. I'll see how many no-shows we have, and then I'll replace the no-shows from students on the wait list. So I go off the wait list first, just by the ranking on the wait list, and if I still need more students and there's petitioners, then I'll hold a lottery for the remaining students to get into class. I have one section that has 24 students in it right now, and of course we want to go to 25, so who's ever first on the wait list, if you show up on that particular, for that particular lab, right, you're pretty much guaranteed an ad code. I don't know who that is, but we could find out who that is in a little bit, maybe after class. So that's how you get in. You need an ad code from me that I give out right at the beginning of lab, if there is room in lab, right? Even I know there's a lot of room in lecture, but not so much in lab. That's what's rate limiting. Okay, anybody have a question about how you can add the class at this time? Got that pretty much. All right, since it's a hybrid class, the first couple meetings are really important. So after the first week, I won't give any add codes, right? So only the first week, even if somebody drops. So this is a good time to remind everybody, if you are registered for the class and for whatever reason you think you might drop even toward the end of this week, let me know so that I can give that spot to another student that is desperate to take this class, okay? So if at all possible, please don't come to the first 2 weeks and then drop the class. Right, that's that doesn't happen so much in physiology, but that happens a lot in anatomy class. So, okay. Let's see, the exams. You see, the first one, what date is the first exam? The 22nd of September. These are the chapters that are going to be on that exam. And I have the chapters that you should be reading corresponding to the particular dates. Now, the way that you prepare for a lecture exam is by using a study guide. Maybe I should close this down and look at Blackboard. Okay, I can minimize this. And all right, so here is a Blackboard course. And those of you that are going to add, I'll give you some instructions on how to get into Blackboard. So this is today's section, this lab. And you see a number of resources in this left-hand frame, including lecture slides, the slides that I'm going to show today. And if you wish to download them and print them out, you certainly are welcome to do that. They're in color. You don't need to have them in color. You can print them in grayscale. But you do need to print them at least two slides per page. And if you can afford one slide per page, that might be pretty good. Then you can write on it. If you do four slides per page, they're way too small to see what's on the diagram because there's a lot of information packed into each slide. Here is your syllabus. Course information probably has a number of different links. I might give you a document that is a Microsoft Word document during the semester. And if you have a Macintosh or if you don't have Microsoft Word running on your computer, you can go over here and get a free reader that will work. You won't be able to edit, but at least you'll be able to see what's on there. Same thing for a PDF reader. Probably everybody has PDF readers now. But if you don't have one in your computer, there's a link to get one for free right in this area. Course information. All right, pre-lecture reading assignments. I have a number of pre-lecture reading assignments in this folder right here, and I also have keys. Okay, you can't see the keys, I don't think, right at the moment, or nothing is enabled. Work through this little quiz. It's just an online, on-paper quiz. You don't turn it in for grading. But if you work through, if you read the chapter and answer those questions, you'll be really prepared for lecture. So you got to do this ahead of time, right? And because I might mention something like homeostasis in lecture, and nobody has heard of that term before they take a physiology class, so the first time you hear it, it just kind of goes right over your head. But if you're familiar with that term before lecture, then when we talk about it, it will make a whole lot more sense. All right, so this is very nice, easy introductory material in these homework assignments. You don't have to do it, but it will pay off in lecture, which then will pay off on the lecture exam for you. So there is a nice payoff for that. Okay, and then after today's lecture, the answer key for this particular homework assignment will appear in that folder that I was going to show you over here. Let me just see, do I have anything in this folder? The answer keys, yes, here's for chapter one, and this will become available after class. Okay. All right, some other things, exam study guides. Sometimes I don't have the right chapter in the right folder here, but I do have four folders. Mostly the chapters are in the right folder, but we might look at, say, chapter number 17, which might be on the third test, but you might find it in a different folder, so just look around. Okay, I'll try to organize that so that's really straightforward. Weekly assignments. This is where you get course points. And as a matter of fact, you could get course points already. If you have taken the syllabus quiz, that's an extra credit quiz. And if you don't do it, it won't count against you. And if you answer a bunch of questions wrong, it won't count against you. Only if you get a point or a number of points, it will count for you, right? That's what extra credit is all about. So that is enabled. All right, so here is the syllabus quiz. Oh, that reminds me something about the syllabus quiz. Okay, this is the extra credit one. Here's the link. You see, we're switching on to this link, and then that will take you to the quiz option in Blackboard, and then you submit, you click submit when you're done with the quiz, and it will be graded before you can even go and look and see what grade you have. It will be fast. It will be immediate, which is really nice. And it will also put it in the grade book. So after you submit any kind of work for course points, right, you should go and check your grade book and make sure it got entered properly. Sometimes it doesn't, especially if you use a mobile device like a cell phone. Right, you can take the quiz and it will congratulate you and say, oh, very good, you got 100%, and then it doesn't transfer your grade into your grade book. So basically you have a zero then. So whenever you submit something, go to your grade book and double check, make sure it's there. Right? And if it's not, then we got to figure out why it is before the deadline. The syllabus tells you what the deadline is. I didn't point it out to you. I kind of scrolled by it. But every week there is a deadline for you to submit online work. And does anybody know? Raise your hand. Who knows what the deadline is? A couple people? Ah, most people. Very good. But I'll just say it out loud. It's every Thursday at 11 p.m. All right? And then after that deadline passes, there's no way that you can go back and take that quiz. So make sure you don't miss a deadline. It's really clear in Blackboard. There's a nice, easy technique to where you can use. If you make a mistake, you won't lose any course points with online quizzes. And should I tell you what that nice little technique is? All right. Just stay 1 week ahead of schedule, right? So if you're ahead of schedule and the week that is active, if by accident you miss that assignment, guess what? It's already done, right? So just stay a little bit ahead of schedule. And these modules are open. I give them to you in chunks, right? Like for the first test, the second test, third test, that kind of thing. Okay. What about that one? Oh. So is there anything that kind of stands out when I'm looking at this web page right here? Anything standing out for you? Sorry, I can't get it on the other screen. I can only project that. So people over here are going to have to take a couple aspirin or something after class is over to help your neck pain. Okay. Usually I like to project on two screens. But does anybody see something interesting on this page that I'm showing right now? Am I showing it? I am showing it. Yeah, the dollar sign. All right. There is a special value of this page, and anytime you see a dollar sign like this, there is going to be an assignment for course points somewhere embedded in this web page, and hopefully it's not hard to find, right? So this is just a nice, quick, easy visual clue for you to pay attention to this page because it's important. It will help determine your grade, and I should probably put like 10 dollar signs here because this is extra credit. All right, so for then the rest of the class is broken down into weeks, week one, week two, all the way to 16. And this is just an index page that will tell you what's happening that week. And you will notice that you will get course points this week if you do something, because that's what that dollar sign says. And it's just the week one, chapter one quiz, which is worth 5 points. And it's going to operate just like the syllabus quiz is. When you're done with that quiz, make sure it gets entered into your grade book properly. And just like the syllabus quiz, all of these online quizzes can be taken an unlimited number of times. I do put a time limit of like 240 hours or something. It will be automatically submitted for you. And that's just so that I don't have to go back in and submit quizzes for people that forget to do that, right? It will close down, but way after you're going to be done with that quiz. So you can take a quiz unlimited number of times until the deadline, and then how many times after the deadline? Zero. Yeah, all right, so that's really abrupt, catastrophic change right there. So again, don't get behind. All right, so pay attention to these dollar signs. If you click into this module here, you'll see objectives that you should be aware of for this particular chapter. Read an objective after you've studied this chapter, and if it doesn't make any sense at all, then you've missed something important. Then you got to go back and find where that concept was talked about in the chapter or in lecture. But when you're done studying, all of these things should make some sense for you. And you'll get these one page at a time. The second page got some animation quizzes. Right, so you can watch an animation and learn something about feedback mechanisms, positive and negative feedback mechanisms. And then, right, oh, this is important. Okay. Here is another page. Every week has this particular page. And Fox, does anybody know what Fox refers to? Your textbook, right? That is just the author of your textbook. And I have some Fox 13. This is the one that is current right now, but here's Fox, earlier edition 9. And I like some of the online questions for these different editions, and I provide links for you. Let's see what happens if I click this thing. It's going someplace. It might ask me, oh, you sure you want to leave Blackboard? And I'm going to say, yeah, I want to leave Blackboard. How come I can't leave Blackboard? Oh, it's the blue one down here. Thank you. Just the little one that I can't see. Okay, so here's a bunch of questions. You only are responsible for the ones that I have listed in Blackboard for you. So make a note of that. And then you can answer these questions. And then at the very end, you can submit. You don't have to submit to me because there's no dollar sign there. But what I like to do is take some of these questions off the internet and put it on your lecture test. Right? So this will help you prepare for lecture exams. So let's go back here. And even back one more. It's going to happen. Great. Okay, so there's a bunch. Some of these questions are duplicate questions, which is okay if you practice it just another time. So these quizzes right here, you should practice them until you can get 100%. Maybe the first time going through a quiz, it might take you 2 hours to go through a quiz. And then the second time, since you're a little bit more familiar, maybe an hour. And then the third time, maybe 15 minutes. And the fourth time, it will take you 5 minutes to get through a quiz. When you can get through a quiz in 5 minutes, then you're ready for the lecture exam, right? But if you're still working through it and learning that information, taking an hour to do it, it's going to be really tough for you on the lecture exam. Okay. The same thing for the pre-lecture reading assignment. These are good before lecture, but if you do the pre-lecture reading assignments before the test, the night before the test, it's too late, right? It's just introductory material. You should really be familiar with that stuff before lecture and way before the lecture exam. Okay, I think I also sent out to everybody a weekly schedule, and it's a study plan for you. So try to find places in your week, times during your week that you can just sequester to have time to study. And that's really the big thing in an anatomy class or a physiology class. You got to find time to work with the information to learn it. And so just start working with that thing right away. Does anybody remember for a college level class like this right here, how many hours a week should you have to study outside of class? 3 hours outside of class for every hour inside of class? I think, yeah, that's a well-published item. So since this is a three-hour class in lecture then, but it's 3 times 3, that's 9 hours per week. Is that right? Yeah, I guess that's right. For some reason, I thought it was 12 hours a week. Maybe that's what I have in the study plan. Okay, so between 9 and 15 hours, that's just to pass the class. But I'm sure everybody in here wants to excel in here because it's really important information that you'll use the rest of your life, but it's also, it will open doors for you in terms of applying to professional programs or graduate school and stuff like that. All right. So work your study time into your schedule and try to protect it. And after the first week, if you can't meet those times that you have written down, then you have to change your schedule somehow, right? Then pick another time where you can get study time or stop doing the things that conflicted with the study time that you thought you actually had, right? So work with that schedule. Show it to your lab instructor, show it to me, and make sure you follow everything there. All right, so these are just different editions of our textbook. What about this page right here? Here is a quiz for course points, because you see that dollar sign. And then here's the link to get into that quiz. Later on in the class, I will put some links in here. You'll see some links that will take you out of Blackboard and into another learning environment that's provided by McGraw-Hill, and that is called Connect. And there's another segment of Connect called Learn Smart. And I can't put dollar signs by those links into Connect and Blackboard because they're not part of Blackboard. but they can help you a lot. So they can be interactive exercises. Learn Smart is an adaptive program. While you take a quiz, it will make note, the computer will make note of your understanding of that material, and then it will redesign questions to ask you to help you learn it. And it might also tell you what page number in the textbook that you can go to learn about that information. All right, the Learn Smart textbook is Fox Edition 13. And what edition are we using in here? 12, so it's not a perfect match. All right, does anybody know why I'm sticking with Edition 12 instead of going to Edition 13? 13 is pretty much the same information, but they changed the figure numbers. They changed the page numbers, right? And my study guides are very specific in terms of what figures you should know, what page numbers, what end of chapter questions you should know, and they just get switched around. It's really the exact same information, all right? The other big reason is the newer editions are always more expensive. Right, so I was just trying to control costs and not switch out editions every couple semesters. Right, so if you have a hardbound version, then you know you have some resale value, but not if I keep switching the editions. Within Connect, you also have the electronic, the e-book available for you to read. Who likes e-books instead of hard copy books? Raise your hand if you like e-books more than hard copy. A couple people. Okay, but not too many. Yeah, I'm in the camp of I like a hard copy of a book. Okay, but that's great if you're familiar with using your computer. If you want to take notes in class with your laptop, that's fine. It's fine with me, or tablet, that's great. Just don't make too much noise if you have a keyboard that's really, really loud. All right, what else do I want to say? You can find your grades. I think you just have to spend some time mousing around in here, and you'll see that it's laid out fairly intuitively. You'll be able to use it pretty easily. You can check your grades right here. This class, the grade scale that's in the syllabus is just a 90-80-70 scale, and there's maybe a little bit of extra credit. Oh, syllabus quiz was extra credit. There's a drawing in lab today, which is extra credit, which is, shows you how to draw a response loop to maintain homeostasis and draw that on a blank piece of paper, and that's going to be worth some extra credit points as well. So every once in a while in lab, there's going to be some extra credit. Maybe an online quiz. There'll be some free questions in there every once in a while, a jackpot. So don't miss any of those weekly quizzes because that might be the week where you get some extra points. All right, so keep looking at that. Anybody have a question about Blackboard? How to log in? Okay, this is the most important thing in the class this week, is to make sure you can log into Blackboard. Those of you that get an ad code today, you will not be able to log in until the day after you register. So register right away. Those of you that are registered, make sure you can log into Blackboard this week so that you're not behind in the class. And I can, if there's a problem, I can usually help you even remotely. So give me an email and I can straighten things out for you, okay? All right, so anybody in here, is tell me if you are registered but cannot get into Blackboard. You tried to get into Blackboard, but you were not able to do that even though you are registered. Does anybody fit that criteria? Raise your hand. So everybody that has tried to get into Blackboard and registered, you were able to do that. That's nice, that's great. Okay. I think that's all I need to say about some of the operations of this particular class. Free tutoring, probably should go over to the Learning Resource Center right away, talk to a tutor and schedule some time because that time evaporates. Right? And maybe in 4 weeks you will realize that you would like to have a tutor, but that tutor might have their schedule all filled up already. Right? So try to get there sooner rather than later. Okay. All right, so that is Blackboard. I'll put that away, and we're going to start talking about some things. Oh, here's something I forgot already. Here's a sign-in sheet for lecture. I just generated this a couple minutes ago, so if you are officially registered in the class, your name is on here. If you don't see your name on here, there's a really good chance you're not registered in the class, and we got to be concerned about that. If you are going to get an ad code later, go ahead and sign at the bottom of the page. There won't be a cell for you to sign in. I will pass around a sign-in sheet every day All right, and if I was teaching lab, it would be lab and lecture, but for sure in lecture, sign it, make sure you sign it, and then that's your receipt that you are in class. And I have kind of a strict attendance policy, and if I drop you during the middle of semester because I think you're not coming to class, then I can pull this out and you can say, well, look, I was there and I was there and I was there. And then I dropped you by accident or negligence or something and we'll get you back in the class. So make sure you sign the sign-in sheet during lecture, right? You can't come to me a week later and say, oh, I forgot to sign the sign-in sheet because I just won't remember, right? So now is the time, sign the sign-in sheet. Like so, find your name on there. Are you guys registered? Good. Good, good, good. And then just kind of pass it down this way, and it will snake around the room. Okay, nice. Those of you that have gotten into Blackboard, was it difficult to do that? For the people that still have to register, let them know, is that difficult to do? Not really, okay, but I'll give you some instructions on how to do that nonetheless. All right. The other thing is, when do we end? 12:45 or 12:15? 12:45? Okay, good. So we got about an hour left in class. All right, so we're going to look at chapter 1. It'd be really nice if you have looked that over a little bit before coming to class. And our first slide right here is interesting and important. All right, I see two terms here, physiology and pathophysiology. And actually, I would like to add a term to this, and that is anatomy. And so we want to understand what anatomy means, what physiology means, what the distinction is. Can anybody tell me what is anatomy? What do you study? What do you learn? The structure of something. That's right, just a three-dimensional structure of some kind of object. It could be a gross structure, like your hand, right, or your ear. But it could also be a molecule. The structure of a molecule is really, really important. All right, so anatomy is the structure of something. And that relates to physiology because the structure of a molecule or the structure of some part of your body determines what the function is. All right, so structure determines function, or another way of saying that is anatomy determines function. And if you change the anatomy of something, what can you guess will happen? Yeah, the physiology changes, or the physiology or the function changes, right? If you change the structure of something, you change the function, how it functions. So on your car, if we change the anatomy of your car, we take the gas pedal out of your car. We're changing the anatomy. What about the function of your car? Well, it's worthless because you don't have a gas pedal, right? So the structure determines the function. I've got a really good hand right here. I still got 5 fingers. I'm really proud of that because I grew up in a machine shop. I could have lost any of these fingers really easily. But let's just say I did. Let's just say I lost my thumb. What happened to the structure of my hand if I lost that thumb in a punch press or something? It would change, right? I wouldn't have that thumb. What about the function of my hand? It would change because then I would lose that nice opposable thumb. I couldn't grasp things. I'd have a hard time writing, right? So if there is a proper physiology or proper function taking place in your body, that means that the structure of everything in your body is proper. And if you change that structure, the physiology is going to change. And that's where we get into pathophysiology. This is where we're going to understand some physiologic processes that alter your homeostasis, right? That produces disease, puts you in a decompensated state. And that happens because there is some change in structure that has taken place in your body. And that change in structure could be a molecule, could be an organelle inside of a cell, right? Could be a pathway of a nerve or an endocrine gland or any of those kinds of things, or structural change in your brain, as a matter of fact, right? Will change your physiology and it could become pathophysiologic. All right, so how do you get from physiology to pathophysiology? What happens? What has to happen? Some structure changes, that's right. Okay, I'm getting my arrow back. Ah, that's much better. Okay, so that's anatomy. Let's start with anatomy, then think of physiology, and then think of pathophysiology. So there was that link of anatomy between physiology and pathophysiology. I want to talk just a little bit about scientific method. so that you appreciate the textbook that you have. All right, so the scientific method means that you have to come up with a guess about how the world operates. Right? And so that guess should be testable. There should be a way that you can find out if that is true or not. And then you design some experiments to test whether that guess is true. That guess is what we call a hypothesis. Right? So a hypothesis is a guess. It's an unproven explanation for something. Unproven explanation. So then some experiments are designed to test the hypothesis. You do the experiments, collect data, and you analyze that data, and then you can come to conclusions about that hypothesis, whether the experimental results support the hypothesis or you realize the hypothesis is not true. Right? And if a lot of people do that all over the world in different kinds of laboratories, pretty much do the same kind of experiments, and they all come up with the same answers that says that the hypothesis is valid, then it becomes a theory. Right? So this is the important point I want to make on this slide. When an idea reaches the level of theory, then it has been tested by the scientific method, and it's something that you can rely on. It's reliable information. If there's information in a hypothesis form, it is not reliable. It's not proven. So that's the really big thing, right? And so what's the reason for the scientific method? It's to give you reliable information. That's the thing, not just a guess, right? And so this process is kind of complicated. It's expensive. And so a lot of people don't like to get into science because of that. But it's really fortunate some people do because it gives you information that you can rely on. So if you're walking down the street with your friends and all of a sudden you have an idea about something and you say, oh, I have a theory about something, and then you explain this theory to your group of friends, all right, chances are, what is that? Is that a theory or a hypothesis? That's a hypothesis, right? But nobody walks down the street with your friends and says, oh, I have a hypothesis about something, right? But you could, if you did that, some people would say, oh, how nice. Yeah, it's not a theory, right? A theory is something you can count on. So a theory is just a general statement explaining some kind of natural phenomena based on a hypothesis that has gone through the rigors of scientific method and has been proven. And then the bottom line for this particular slide is, in your textbook, the information in your textbook is at the level of theory, not at the level of hypothesis. Right, so when you're reading some of this stuff in physiology, you're going to say, oh, this is so strange, it can't possibly be true. But what should you realize? It is true. It is reliable information, right? Okay, it's not at the level of hypothesis. I might tell you that I might have a guess about something and explain something that's very interesting, maybe a new idea, but I'll always tell you that it's not theory, right? It is hypothesis, and you should keep an open mind about that particular item. All right, so when you test a hypothesis, you have to perform experiments, and in order to make sure the experiments give you valid information, we like to have at least two groups of people, right? If we're working on something that will affect people, you have to have two groups, an experimental group and a control group. This is important because whenever you work with people, you will influence their physiology, how they behave. Right, and so if we're looking at the effects of a particular drug, like maybe an estrogen-type drug, and you're going to learn that that's a lipid, that's a fat, and does fat dissolve in water? No. Right? You need to have that particular pharmaceutical agent dissolved in oil and then given to somebody. And just that oil might influence the physiology of that person. So you're going to have an experimental group that gets a shot of oil and the hormone, and then you're going to have a control group that's treated exactly the same way. They get the shot of oil, they got to go to the hospital, et cetera, right? But in the oil is no active ingredient. So you can make a really nice comparison to see what's going on, right? Not from getting a shot, not from just getting a shot of oil, but just from getting that particular pharmaceutical agent. So we say that this group over here controls the information, so we know what is happening. That becomes a control group or a sham group. And the subjects in that particular study should not know what group they're in. They should probably not even know that there are groups. And the people that are doing the experiments, administering the drugs, should not know anything about the study either, because they might have a different attitude when they talk to the participants of the study, right, which will influence the results. And when we do something like that, we call that a blind experiment, and that gives you the most important information. Right? And that's kind of what makes education really difficult, because I would like to change things in this class to make it better, have people learn more, but I can never have a control group, right, because I just can't break the class up into students that I know are going to do better compared to those that I know are not going to do better. So that's a difficulty. So sometimes it's hard in education to know how to improve a teaching method. And it would only be me, and I would know that there are two different groups, and I might just be more excited about some kind of teaching technique that I thought maybe I was developing, okay, which is going to change results. All right, when you have results, then the best scientific method is when you can come up with a quantitative measure of that variable that you're trying to look at. And what I mean is, if you think maybe there should be a change in somebody's temperature, right, then you should use a thermometer. And a thermometer can give you a particular number, right? And so that's what we mean by quantitative. So something that maybe doesn't turn color or gets warmer or colder, right? We want to come up with a number from a machine that has been calibrated, so we know that that number is valid. And we said perform blindly means that nobody knows what's going on except for the person that is coordinating the studies. When these quantitative measures are written down, put in a nice spreadsheet, then the analysis of that data should be done using statistical methods. Right, so that's just a mathematical method of looking at the data to see if there really is a difference between these two groups, or could it be explained just by random chance. And hopefully it's not just random chance. Statistics will give you a sense of whether or not there really is a difference between these two groups, the experimental and control group. All right, so you can see that there's a lot of things going on here. It's a little bit boring to listen to an instructor talk about this stuff, right? So it is expensive. But what is the purpose of going through all of this rigmarole right here? To give you reliable information. So what is the purpose of the scientific method? Gives you reliable information, or information that you can count on. Okay, and everything in your book is at the level of theory. It is something that you can count on. Homeostasis, very important term. The whole class revolves around this particular term right here. And homeostasis is some kind of state inside your body where there is a parameter that could be blood pressure, could be temperature, could be glucose concentration in your blood, or anything that is necessary to maintain your life, like maybe oxygen concentration, CO2 concentration. Right, so homeostasis just means that particular parameter, let's just say temperature, okay, it can change a little bit, but it can't change drastically, right? Because if it changes drastically, then you can't maintain your life. So homeostasis means that some parameter can increase, can decrease, but it's always going to go back to some normal value, which is suitable to support life. So homeostasis is a dynamic state where everything is changing. Your blood pressure is changing, your water balance is changing, your pH is changing all the time, but only in very small increments, so that parameter never produces a disease state in somebody. All right, I mentioned pH. Does anybody know what pH means? After the class, you'll know. I mean, not today, but after the course is over, you'll know. But right now, does anybody have a sense of what pH is? I mentioned pH. Yeah.
Level of acidity.
Yeah, it's a nice level measurement of acidity, right, as opposed to being alkaline or basic. And it's tightly regulated inside our body if it changes a little bit, that really changes the metabolism. It changes the structure of a bunch of chemicals, right? And that's going to change how these chemicals function inside your body. So pH has to be maintained in a very small range that supports life. All right, so we say it's a dynamic state. Things are constantly changing and adjusting to the changing internal and external conditions, right? Internal conditions inside your body and external conditions like temperature and light and all that kind of stuff that's outside your body. Oxygen concentration, for instance. All right, how is homeostasis maintained? Well, there has to be communication between different parts of your body, different cells in your body. Here are three ways that we can think of how your body is coordinated. And the first thing right here is that we have a hormonal mechanism for control. Here we have a cell, and we see it's a hormone-secreting gland cell. So a gland is something that secretes a product that it produces. And that product that the gland cell secretes ends up in a blood vessel, right? And once it's in the blood vessel, where does it go? Everywhere where your blood goes, right? Which is pretty much everywhere in your body. And this hormone, right, is the product that was secreted by this secreting gland. And this hormone then gets everywhere in your body, and it can affect certain tissues, right, that we call a target tissue if it has a particular item, right? And in order to be a target tissue, there has to be a receptor to this particular hormone. If a cell doesn't have a receptor to this hormone, then it's going to be completely blind, won't know that the hormone is in the blood whatsoever. Like, for instance, if you want to be able to sense light, what do you need? You need photoreceptors in your eyes, right? If you do not have photoreceptors, then, of course, you won't know anything about the light conditions that you're in. Same thing for this target tissue. It has to have a receptor. And the receptor, will know there's a hormone because there's going to be a nice complementation of shape. And so, again, the anatomy of the hormone and the anatomy of the receptor have to match up just perfectly in order for this cell over here to control these target cells at some distant location inside the body. So here is what we said, a secreting gland cell. And some of you probably should know what kind of secreting gland cell there is. Remember, there are two major kinds. There are two major kinds of secretions or glands that produce secretions. Anybody remember what the two major categories are? Exocrine, fantastic. Even after summer, good, thanks for reminding me. You got exocrine and endocrine, okay? And the kind of cell that we're looking at right here is an endocrine gland, right? So an endocrine gland produces a hormone. And the definition of a hormone is that it's a signaling molecule that gets secreted from an endocrine gland. It enters the blood, travels to a distant location in your body, and it produces, it changes the physiology of that cell, produces a very specific response. All right, so that's the definition of a hormone. It goes to some distant location in your body and changes the physiology of these distant parts in your body. All right, so an endocrine gland, remember, is a ductless gland, and an exocrine gland has a duct, like a sweat gland has ducts and pores, right, that take sweat to the surface of your body. Not so for endocrine gland. So what is replacing the duct system for an endocrine gland is the blood, right? That's what is carrying this particular signaling compound all over your body. Doesn't need a duct because it goes into the blood. All right, here is an example of a neurotransmitter. We're going to talk a lot about neurotransmitters in here. Neurotransmitter, again, is a signaling molecule. It's secreted by a neuron. That's why it's called neurotransmitter. All right, so here is a neuron, and neurons are really nice because they can transmit information long distances very rapidly in your body. When that nerve impulse reaches the axon terminus, it releases a chemical compound that we call a neurotransmitter, which can then diffuse to neighboring cells, and it can change the physiology of these neighboring cells if there is a receptor to that particular neurotransmitter. So it's a neural part of neurotransmitter is because it's secreted by a neuron, and transmitter is because it transmits information from the neuron to some other cell, and a lot of times it's going to be another nerve cell, but it could be some other kind of, it could be a muscle cell that's being instructed to contract, right? That's still a neurotransmitter because that compound has come from a neuron. All right, so that's different, right, than this hormonal way of controlling your body. Then, here's a little complicated item. What kind of cell do we have right here that I'm circling? It's a nerve cell or a neuron, so it's going to secrete a chemical, a signaling compound, right? And so then we would like to call that a neurotransmitter, right? Because it's being secreted by a neuron. But in this particular case, that signaling compound diffuses into a capillary into the blood, and then the blood takes that signaling compound and distributes it all over the body. So in this particular case, this signaling compound kind of looks like a neurotransmitter because it came from a neuron, but it also kind of looks like a hormone because it's distributed by a blood vessel. Right? So this is a long range. It's not just by a neighboring cell. So sometimes it's really hard to understand if something is a neurotransmitter or if it's a hormone. And as a matter of fact, we need to come up with another name. That's what we would call a neurohormone. Neurohormone secreted by a neuron, but it's distributed in the body by the vascular system. Goes to some distant target location, and it changes the physiology of those cells. After it binds to something, what does it have to bind to make this a target tissue or a target cell? The neurohormone has to bind to a receptor, and it does by the shape, right? There's a complementary shape of the molecule. It has to have a proper shaped receptor in order for it to bind. All right, so these are some examples of how long-range reflexes can take place. Short-range reflexes, here we have a local cell, and it secretes some kind of compound, and that compound diffuses just in this little local neighborhood. It doesn't go very far, but it can't control cells in this neighborhood if it has a receptor to this particular signaling molecule. That's what we would call a paracrine agent. Right, diffusion can take place only under very short distances, or only four short distances, and we have to talk about diffusion in this class. I know I use the term that you're not familiar with yet, but it's a way that molecules can move from one area to another area, and we're going to see how that works. All right, here is another. This is kind of strange. We're learning more about this thing. Here is a cell, and it wants to change the physiology of itself for whatever reason. Okay? It can secrete a signaling compound, and once it gets outside the cell, it can bind to a receptor that is extracellular, and when this autocrine agent binds to a receptor, it will change the physiology inside the cell. So that's what we call an autocrine. Auto because the physiology of the cell that secreted that signaling compound is changed. Right? It's the exact same cell. And we're going to see how that signal actually goes across the membrane. That's pretty interesting. Okay, so let's get back to homeostasis. So some people say it's a state of dynamic constancy. Well, these two terms are sort of contradictory to each other. How can something be steady? How can something be constant but changing all the time? All right, so let's look at an example. So here we have... Okay, this could be any kind of physiologic parameter. This could be oxygen concentration in your body. This could be blood glucose concentration. This could be blood pressure. Could be temperature, right? And let's just say it is glucose concentration. And we're measuring somebody's blood glucose concentration. And in this period of time, what can you tell me about this person's blood glucose concentration? Let's see if you can read this graph right here. We're reading a graph. Yeah, it is increasing, right? I see a little arrow right here. So during this particular time, so this is a graph of, we have to label the axes right here, blood glucose concentration versus time. So in order to appreciate a graph, what you should look at first are the axes for that particular graph to know what the dimensions are. So we're looking at blood glucose versus time, and what's happening during over time in this location of the graph is that blood glucose level is increasing. Right? Well, we know that blood glucose should be maintained within a certain range that's suitable to support life. So when the blood glucose concentration increases to a point, then something changes in your body to do what? What about this arrow right here? It decreases the blood glucose concentration. And when it decreases to a sufficient level, your body has to change to do what? Increase it once again, right? So here you see blood glucose going up, going down, going up, going down. And so it is not constant. It's changing all the time, but it's changing over a very little range, right? And the very center part of that range right here, if we just take a mathematical average of all this information, then, well, we get the average. That average is what we call the set point. So whenever you see a parameter moving away from the set point, okay, that's very dangerous. When blood glucose concentration decreases too much or too high, or if your temperature increases way too high, that's hyperthermia, that is deadly. Or if your body temperature decreases too much, that's hypothermia, that is deadly. Right? If that parameter goes back down to the set point, whether it's below the set point or above the set point, then we can say that your body is maintaining homeostasis. Right? So whenever you see a graph where the parameter is forced back down to the set point or back up to the set point, then we know that homeostasis is taking place, which is a normal thing that happens in our body. And it does that with what we call negative feedback loops. That's what this little minus sign is right here. And in the next couple of slides, I'll show you what negative feedback means. Okay, so there's nothing constant, right? They're just changes, small changes in your body. All right, so what is a negative feedback loop? Let's look at, this is what you pretty much have to draw in lab today. When are we done?
12:45.
Oh, good, 12:45. Fantastic. All right, so let's look at our illustration right here. The one that I want you to draw in lab is a little bit better, but this is pretty good. Here we have some kind of parameter, X. This could be body temperature, blood glucose concentration, pH, or whatever, right? And here we see an up arrow. This means that the, what do you want to use? Well, we'll use temperature once again. Let's say that X is temperature. This up arrow means that temperature is increasing. Right? And so in order for your body to appreciate that your body temperature is increasing, what do you have to have? You have to have a thermometer someplace in your body. You have to have a sensor, right? And there are temperature receptors in your brain, your hypothalamus, that can monitor your temperature and is doing it all the time, right? So the temperature is monitored by the sensor, and that doesn't really do much for you because that information then has to be sent someplace to where it can be appreciated. And that place that appreciates that information is called the integration center. And the way information from the center gets into the integration center is by this pathway right here. This could be a neuron. And what do we call a neuron that takes information into the central nervous system? Afferent or sensory. Afferent, sensory, same thing. Right, so this thing right here is the afferent neuron, brings information into the integration center. Integration center is really important because it has the set point. It knows what the set point of that particular parameter is, and it compares the set point to the information that it's getting from the sensor, and if the set point is equal to the information coming from the receptor, what does the integration center have to do? If your body is at the exact same temperature at the set point? Nothing, right? Because nothing has to change. You're at perfect body temperature. All right, so this integration center can measure differences, and based on that difference, it can make a decision on what to do, right? If your body temperature is too high, it makes a decision. If it's too low, it makes a different decision to force temperature back to the set point. And how can it change your body? How can it change temperature in your body? Well, it sends its decision out through this neuron here to an effector. So let's just say your body temperature decreased a lot, and this here is a muscle, right? And that muscle is going to produce heat in your body. which is going to compensate for that decreased body temperature, which started this whole thing. So what is this pathway here that takes information away from the central nervous system to a skeletal muscle?
Efferent,
right? So here is an efferent pathway. Doesn't always have to be a neuron, but in the case we're looking at, that works pretty well. Right? And then the effector, right? We see a decrease in temperature. What started this whole loop? An increase. So what can you tell me about the relationship between increase and decrease temperature? Do they add together or do they subtract? Yeah, they subtract from each other, right? And that's why we consider this a negative feedback mechanism. Right, the last thing I want to fill in here is that this up arrow, I see number one, this is always what we call a stimulus, right? A stimulus is appreciated by a sensor, which sends information into the integration center via an afferent pathway. Integration center makes a decision on what to do, sends that information out through an efferent pathway to an effector organ. And what does an effector organ always produce? I see it over here, a response, right? So here we have a nice response loop, right? A nice simple way of thinking of this, a response loop. A response loop always starts with a stimulus and it ends in a response. And if we plot these, if we plot this response out or this parameter over time, so here is maybe temperature versus time, we can, and here is the set point. It's not drawn in as a line, but you could, in your imagination, draw it in as a line. So here, somebody's body temperature is too low, right? And then it starts to increase. The integration center says, oh, let's activate this muscle right here. That starts to contract, produces heat. Body temperature increases. The sensor then realizes, oh, your body's getting too hot. Okay, then what does the integration center do? It tells the muscle, okay, you can stop shivering and we need to start sweating, so it sends information to sweat glands, a totally different kind of effector organ, which then cools your body down. All right, and it still uses this negative feedback. The final point on this is, almost the final point, is that when I look at this parameter, body temperature, increasing and then decreasing and then increasing again, then I understand automatically that homeostasis is taking place, right? That dynamic constancy. This variable is not changing very much, but it is not static. It's not absolutely constant. All right, so is X constant over time? No, but it's changing under very small distances. It doesn't change very much. All right, so here is something interesting. When you start to sweat to cool your body down, now you start to lose water in your body, right? So that disrupts another parameter that's necessary to support life. So then your kidneys have to compensate for that water loss, right? And so that brings the water concentration in your body back, right? So no parameter in your body is constant, right? Everything is changing all the time so that not one parameter has to change beyond this normal range. So another way that I like to think of homeostasis is that it's a dance, right? It's a dance of blood pressure, hormone concentration, pH, blood glucose levels. All of these things, all these parameters are dancing around each other, but none of them dance so far that it produces a disease state. So everything is changing all the time. All right, so here is the diagram I want you to draw in lab, and it's a response loop. Here are the pieces of a response loop, so make sure you can name all of these different steps in a response loop and then draw it out in this nice flow diagram. A lot of us are really good at anatomy by this point in time, right? We have really good visual learning skills and techniques. Physiology is not like that, so whenever I can draw out a concept map, I like that because you're familiar with learning structures of things, right? So learn the structure of the response loop with this little diagram. Yeah?
Is it always increasing?
It's always negative feedback. Yeah, I'm going to talk a little bit more about that. Yeah. If it goes up above the set point and then returns, or it goes below the set point and returns to set point, that is negative feedback taking place. Yeah. Okay. So what does a response loop always start with? Stimulus. And what does your body have to appreciate that stimulus? A sensor. And how does that information enter the integration center through a afferent pathway. Here's that integration center. A lot of times it's in the central nervous system, right? So that would be an afferent neuron. The integration center has something. What does it have? It's not on the drawing, but it's over here. It has a set point. So it compares the information with a set point. That's what I mean by analysis. So it can analyze that information, and then it can make a decision on what to do. It sends that decision right out the efferent pathway to an effector organ, and the effector organ is always going to produce a response, right? And if homeostasis is maintained, what should be the relationship between stimulus and response? They should be opposite each other, right? And if they're opposite each other, this feedback loop right here is a negative feedback loop if they subtract from each other, right? If this response, and let's just say this is temperature, let's just say there was an increase in temperature picked up by the, that's a stimulus, the receptor picks it up, and for some reason, this effector right here increases body temperature more. So the stimulus is an increase in body temperature that produces a further increase in body temperature, which produces a further increase in body temperature. So now you can see your temperature is getting hotter and hotter and hotter and hotter. And that's what we call a positive feedback mechanism, when the response adds to the stimulus. It doesn't cancel out. Okay. So what maintains homeostasis or a normal disease-free state is a negative feedback loop. So that term is a little bit misleading. It's a good mathematical term, negative feedback. But usually negative has kind of a bad connotation to it, right? Positive has a good connotation to it, not in terms of control systems, right? Negative feedback is what maintains a nice healthy state. So here's a slide that you can answer pretty easy. All right, so negative feedback versus positive feedback. Negative, any kind of body mechanism that resists a change. Right, and that change is from that set point or normal value, and that change is resisted, so that that change then goes back down to the set point. Negative feedback leads to a compensated, healthy state and maintains homeostasis. So your question was right on. Negative feedback always maintains homeostasis. We'll talk maybe about a couple exceptions to that rule, not too many. All right, so the response subtracts from the stimulus, moving the system back to set point, and since it subtracts, we call that negative feedback. Positive feedback, the only thing you have to change is that the response adds to the stimulus, and that moves that parameter farther and farther away from set point. So if your body temperature was increasing, it would cause a further increase in temperature and a further increase in temperature, and all of a sudden you just burst in a big ball of flames. Okay. So positive feedback is disease producing. Okay, different kinds of control. Some regulatory mechanism. Intrinsic control is automatically built into the organ that has to be adjusted. So it doesn't require outside influences. And you all probably have seen like Raiders of the Lost Ark, somebody ripped somebody's heart out and they put it on some altar, right? And the heart is doing what after ripped out of somebody's chest? It still beats, and indeed it does, right? Because of intrinsic control. The heart can regulate itself, and this is usually good, sometimes bad. The heart can regulate itself, doesn't need nervous system, doesn't need endocrine system, okay? And the principle that regulates the heart is what we call the Frank-Starling Law. We're going to talk about that pretty extensively, probably in about 6, 7, 8 weeks. That's pretty much down in the later in the class. But the heart can help, can regulate itself. We call that an intrinsic mechanism. If there is some kind of regulation mechanism that is outside the heart, right, that controls the heart, like maybe hypothalamus or the brainstem, then we would not call that intrinsic. We would call that extrinsic. Right. So extrinsic controls comes from outside the organ, and body temperature is a pretty good example of that, because what happens outside your body, okay, is what's controlling whether you shiver or you sweat. Okay. I don't want to make this antagonistic is really important, but I don't want to talk about it on this slide. You can kind of ignore it on this slide. All right, so here we see body temperature versus time. And if you just look at this really quickly, can you tell if homeostasis is being maintained? Yeah, because this parameter is always being forced to the set point, whether it's too high or too low. All right, and what kind of feedback mechanism is being used right here? Yeah, negative feedback, right? So that's just something that we talked about. Here's another graph, blood glucose concentration versus time. And let's see what is happening here. Here is somebody with normal blood glucose concentration up to this point. And then that normal person is injected with insulin. All right, so they have agreed to this. We don't do this normally, right? Somebody that has normal blood glucose, we don't give them insulin. But insulin is a signal that allows cells in your body to absorb glucose from the blood. It's like a passport. Insulin is a passport that allows glucose to enter cells. Without that passport, glucose can't get into cells. All right, so now we've injected a person with insulin, and we've told all the cells in your body, go ahead and absorb glucose, and they can. So what happens to blood glucose if it's taken out of the blood? It goes down, right? So here we force somebody's blood glucose concentration to go down because we gave them this injection of insulin, and indeed it went down. All right, and I'm going to stop talking right here because I have a question. Okay, is homeostasis being maintained? We have one challenge to this person. We've given them one injection that forced a rapid decline in blood glucose. All right, but if we look at the rest of this graph over here, okay, can you tell if homeostasis is being maintained and whether or not there's negative feedback taking place? Okay. The answer is yes, because if there was positive feedback, what would happen to blood glucose concentration? It would continue to decrease. It won't go negative, right? But it would continue to decrease. But since it recovers, right, it's forced back to the set point, we know that there is negative feedback mechanism taking place to maintain proper blood glucose levels in your blood, and that is a way of maintaining homeostasis using a negative feedback mechanism. And we're going to learn a lot about that. Okay, there is now a good time to talk about antagonism. You learned about antagonism in terms of the musculoskeletal system, right? Because there are some muscles that produce flexion. There are other muscles that produce extension, right? Opposite motion. So usually when you think of antagonistic mechanisms or antagonism, again, it has kind of a bad connotation to it, right? But in terms of control theory, antagonistic mechanisms provide for precise control and balance. So antagonism is a very wonderful thing. It's built automatically into your musculoskeletal system because you have opposing muscles. It's built into your nervous system in a little bit different way because how many divisions do you know of for the autonomic nervous system? Is autonomic nervous system by itself, or can you break it down into some smaller divisions? Autonomic nervous system. There's a sympathetic and a parasympathetic, and they are antagonistic to each other. So you might say, well, why do we have these two things that are antagonistic to each other? Because they're just going to cancel out, right? Well, you're going to see that's really not the case, right? They do cancel out, all right? When something cancels out, what does that produce? A positive feedback mechanism or a negative feedback mechanism? A negative feedback mechanism. And what does a negative feedback mechanism produce? Homeostasis, right? So antagonistic mechanisms actually help you maintain homeostasis. And we'll have to give you some really good examples. Here's a good beginning. Let me see what's on the next slide. Okay. All right. Well, so insulin, we have two hormones, right? Blood glucose is controlled via antagonistic mechanism. The first hormone, insulin decreases blood glucose, and since we see a nice negative feedback mechanism taking place, what could you guess? If insulin decreases blood glucose, there is another hormone that increases blood glucose. So these two things working together, even though they're antagonistic, produces what? A beautiful negative feedback mechanism that maintains homeostasis. We talk a lot about insulin, right? Everyday life, not so much that other hormone. Does anybody know what the name of that other hormone is that increases blood glucose? It is called, yeah, it's called glucagon, right? So glucagon and insulin are antagonistic to each other, and how they operate produces precise control and balance of blood glucose, which is really important. What about your automobile? Do you have any antagonistic mechanisms in your automobile? Your gas pedal and your brake pedal, right? So again, right, they're antagonistic, but it provides for precise control and balance of the speed of your vehicle. If you only had a gas pedal, you could drive home after work, but you just have to wave bye because you couldn't stop, right? So antagonistic control is beautiful in that sense. All right, so same thing with the biceps and triceps. What is today, Tuesday? Oh, you're going to have to go until Friday. Let's just say Friday, you get pulled over by that person in the fancy blue uniform, the badge and the sidearm, and they say, take your index finger and put it on your nose, like that. So they are doing what? A sobriety test, right? They're actually checking to see if you have good antagonistic control of that finger. And you could actually tell them that, oh, officer, I have perfect antagonistic control. My biceps and triceps are working precisely so I can put my finger on my nose. Well, today maybe I wouldn't say anything about antagonism when talking to an officer, right? They might not understand that. Okay, so antagonistic mechanisms are wonderful inside your body. Positive feedback, we say, drives a parameter away from the set point, produces a disease state, but there are some rare examples where positive feedback is normal. Right? It doesn't maintain homeostasis, but it changes something for a short period of time to produce a healthy situation. Right? And here are a couple examples. We'll talk about these in more detail in the other parts of the class. It's involved with blood clotting. Positive feedback, there are positive feedback loops in blood clotting so that when you cut yourself, it forms a clot rapidly. Right? So that you don't have to wait a long time to form a clot. So positive feedback sometimes can enhance the speed of some important effect that needs to take place in your body. All right, there's a positive feedback mechanism when a woman ovulates. There are some hormones in your body, and the one that's most important is luteinizing hormone. All right, so luteinizing hormone increases, that causes a further increase in luteinizing hormone, that causes a further increase of luteinizing hormone, which is a nice positive feedback mechanism. And how come the whole universe isn't filled up with luteinizing hormone? Because something drastic happens, right? It changes that positive feedback loop, and that is called ovulation, right? So, and that's a kind of a catastrophic event. That egg can never go back inside the ovary, right? So usually something catastrophic happens to break that positive feedback loop. And in this particular case, ovulation. There's also positive feedback between the uterus and a fetus during parturition, that's childbirth, right? That's mediated by oxytocin. Oxytocin is a powerful stimulant of smooth muscle. The uterus is made out of smooth muscle. Oxytocin comes from, anybody remember where oxytocin comes from? Just barely touched on that in anatomy. Part of the pituitary, in particular the posterior pituitary, you'll be familiar with that, okay? And so what happens here at the end of pregnancy, at the end of term, the fetus feels a lot of stress. They secrete stress hormones because they're being more and more confined in a small space. Those stress hormones then feed back to the posterior pituitary in the woman, and the woman releases oxytocin, which causes constriction of the uterus, and then how does the fetus feel? More constrained. Secretes more stress hormone, which causes the release of more oxytocin, which causes the release of more stress hormone. And then how come the whole universe isn't filled up with oxytocin? Yeah, something happens. Something drastic happens, right? Then somebody is born. Okay, so here's an example, positive feedback, but it can't go on forever. And here's another example, don't want to talk about it right now. An action potential is something that a neuron does. And it's an action potential in motion. An action potential along an axon in a neuron is what we call a nerve impulse. So action potential in motion is a nerve impulse. And maybe you've heard of nerve impulses, right? It's just a way of sending electrical information very fast down an axon of a neuron. And again, if something has to happen real fast, then maybe positive feedback can take place for a short period of time before something drastic happens. Here is a really nice response loop, and this one has to do with controlling blood pressure. Pressure is a force that can move a fluid from one place to another place. And so blood is a fluid, and it has to move through your body, so there is a place where there has to be high pressure, and there has to be a place where there's low pressure. The place where there is high pressure is inside the heart. When the heart contracts, right, the pressure goes up, and blood can flow through your cardiovascular system because there's very low pressure in veins. All right, so when you're lying down, let's just say this person is normal, but when you stand up, okay, then gravity is going to decrease the pressure in your head. Right? And as a matter of fact, some of you, when you stand up maybe really rapidly from just a sitting position, might notice that. You might feel maybe a little dizzy or something, okay, because blood pressure is decreasing. So here we have a decrease in blood pressure when there's a change in body position. Right? So what do we call that change in blood pressure? Change in blood pressure in this response loop right here. That's the stimulus, and your body can tell if there's a drop in blood pressure because your body has what? A receptor for blood pressure. Right? So there are blood pressure receptors. That's the sensor part. And these things we call baroreceptors, like a barometer is something that measures atmospheric pressure. You have barometers inside your body that measure blood pressure. So what we just call these baroreceptors. They send that pressure information into the medulla via what kind of nerve? An afferent neuron. These pressure receptors are in your carotid sinus. They're also on the arch of the aorta. And that goes into the medulla. This is where your cardioregulatory center is. It can compare that information with the set point, so it knows if your blood pressure is increasing or decreasing, and it can make a decision on what to do. If your blood pressure is decreasing, like it says right here, what's the decision that the cardioregulatory center in the medulla makes? We got to do something to increase blood pressure, like send signals to the heart to increase heart rate and maybe even increase the force of contraction so that it pumps more blood faster, right? And so that increases blood pressure, right? So, and that's what we call a response. And what's the relationship between the response, an increase in blood pressure, with the stimulus, which was a decrease? Negative. Yeah, it's negative feedback. So here is a nice negative feedback loop that's maintaining homeostasis. Right, and we also notice that this information is being transmitted by neurons. It goes into the brain, which is a neuron, right? It goes to the heart, which is a neuron. So when it's using a nervous system, it's a rapid response. So this reflex is something that can control your blood pressure very rapidly, so we call that short-term regulation. You don't have high blood pressure because of this mechanism, right? This can regulate your blood pressure from second to second, but not day to day or week to week. The other kind of mechanism that works over the long term would be like an endocrine system, right? Endocrine system takes a long time to develop, but it lasts for a longer period of time. In lab, you're going to work with the baroreceptor reflex a lot. Okay, so here is something that we talked about a little bit already. I think this is the last slide. Right here, blood glucose. Okay, and I see two columns over here. And that kind of corresponds to how many hormones help regulate blood glucose in your body. Yeah, there are two, insulin and glucagon. Okay. You can be in two states in terms of blood glucose. You could be in a fed state. They say eating here, but usually we say fed state. You could be in a fed state, and what have you just done, or what are you doing when you're in a fed state? You are eating, yeah, so this makes sense, right? You could be in a fed state, and opposite to that is a fasted state. You're either fasted or fed. All right, so if you're fed, you're eating glucose. Right? That glucose is absorbed by your digestive tract. So what happens to blood glucose when you eat something? Like a big Slurpee, candy bar. Blood glucose increases above normal. Well, we want to maintain what? A more constant blood glucose. So blood glucose, or blood, goes to the pancreas, and the pancreas has glucose receptors. and it can monitor and tell that blood glucose is increasing. It's got to make a decision on what to do. The pancreas itself can secrete insulin, which is the passport that allows glucose to enter cells. Blood glucose concentration does what? It goes down, right? So insulin causes an increase of glucose uptake in cells, and that decreases blood glucose. Initial response was an increase. I mean, the stimulus was an increase, the response was a decrease. Nice negative feedback mechanism when blood glucose concentration increases when you're in a, what kind of state? A fed state. Let's look at the fasted state. If you're in a fasted state, your glucose is not entering your body from the food that you're eating because you have no food in your digestive tract, so blood glucose decreases, but that's pretty much okay because there's an organ that can monitor blood glucose. There are glucose receptors in what organ? Pancreas, right? A particular part of the pancreas, right? The cells of Langerhans right here. So the pancreas has a set point, can make a decision, and its decision would be to increase insulin if there was a decrease. No, because insulin decreases blood glucose, so the pancreas cuts back the secretion of insulin and starts the secretion of another hormone that's antagonistic to it, which is glucagon. Glucagon increases blood glucose concentration by decreasing cellular uptake of glucose, opposite action compared to insulin. And glucagon also goes to the liver, and you have a nice storage form, a reservoir of glucose in your liver, and it tells the liver to secrete that glucose into the blood, and when liver secretes glucose into the blood, what happens to blood glucose concentration? It goes up, right? So blood glucose concentration is going up and down all day long, depending on whether you're fed or fasted, and that is what we call homeostasis. Does anybody know the form of glucose in your liver? Okay, it's not really glucose in your liver, it's stored in a special form in your liver. It's like starch, but it's called glycogen. Glycogen is like starch, it's just the building block is glucose, and it's like what you find in a potato or pasta, but it's a little bit different form. Glucagon has a way to tell the liver to chop off one glucose at a time and put it in the blood, therefore increasing blood glucose concentration. All right, so don't forget, homeostasis means that all parameters in your body are changing, constantly changing, adjusting for other changes that are taking place in your body, but all of those changes happen over a very narrow range that's suitable to support life. And that's why I kind of think of it as a dance of all these different parameters, because they affect each other and what they do. All right, so I think a sign-in sheet is going around. You're always responsible for signing that sign-in sheet. It should have your name on it if you're registered. If you're not, maybe see me right now. And now I got to go up to lab. And some of you have to go up to lab too.